We're glad that you're here. The first question is, what should a wife do if her husband refuses to correct and repent of using pornography?
Okay. First is, are we all close enough we can hear each other? Okay. One of the things that I do in therapy is I don't tell people what they should do. What I do is I offer alternatives, and I recommend that people be willing to live with those alternatives. The problem with giving advice or saying should, this is what you should do, often then I end up being the bad guy if they turns bad. I don't like being the bad guy. So I can tell you what others have done, and I can tell you what direction that I would recommend. Basically, the question has to do with a husband who refuses to correct and repent of pornography. The thing that we've talked about all week is, if nothing changes, then nothing changes. That if we allow ourselves to be held captive for fear of that my marriage may end, or if I push this, so there'll be some bad consequence, then we are held captive, and the addict likes to be in that spot. Because what they've done is they've actually put you at bay. They put you into a stalemate, and they can do what they want to do, and they're feeding off of your fear. Remember, what fear does is a character defect. So basically what I would say needs to happen is that first the person needs to be confronted. They need to be confronted strongly. If they continue in this activity, then the question that I would ask is it at the point that someone needs to make a choice? The addict has already made a choice that they are going to stay in this addictive behavior. So the family member is going to have to make a choice. For some, and I hate saying this in a congregation, but for some, that has been that we are putting a season of meditation, a season of separation between us. For some, it goes to those extremes. I will not live with this if this is what you're going to do. I will not live with the images of another woman in my bedroom. I will not live with the stuff that you are doing that ultimately is going to break up the marriage. Now, that's a pretty drastic measure. The basis I would use in Scripture for that would be 1 Corinthians 7, where there may be a period of time that a couple may be apart for a season to give themselves to fasting and prayer. This is probably one of those times. And so fasting and prayer has to do with not just saying, okay, we're going to split for a little while. This is, we need to back up, both of us, and think seriously about what's going on here, because this has to stop. Again, I would recommend that that would be for a season, that is for a short time. That would be in the extreme. And I really hate even suggesting something like that, but extreme measures often beget extreme actions. The things that would be less intrusive to a marriage and maybe are better places to start, first see if the person would be willing to go and get therapy. That's a good place to start. Say something like, we're going to need marital therapy. And would you be willing to go and let's talk this through? In those cases, you're going to get into the actual addiction stuff in the course of the therapy, and it will be addressed. Again, then that is going to mean that you need to find someone that's going to give you wise spiritual counsel in addition to other kinds of counsel. I would strongly advise involving the leaders of the church in this, where they are not operating in the dark and kind of coming in after the fact on this thing. It's a time when addiction has such a strong hold on a person that they're refusing to correct and to repent of the use of their pornography, then the question becomes, how far are you willing to push this? How much are you willing to live with? And here's what you know, that this kind of evil does not get better, and it certainly doesn't get better on its own, unless there's an intervention of some sort. So, it's a time for tough decisions. But a week away, a few weeks away, time to think about it, then that would be something that could be done. Okay? The other piece is, Peter talked about the wife that can win her unbelieving husband through the chaste behavior coupled with fear. And that would be another one. I would not, and with that passage, I would not hound the guy. So don't hover and smother and demand. Just kind of set your boundary. This is the boundary. If you do this, then I'll do this. So we have a choice to make. Okay?
The next question is, what if the want or desire to quit an addiction is not there? How do we instill it?
Okay. All right. If the desire to quit an addiction is not there. Question that would come up here is that many times the desire to quit the addiction is not an internal desire. There are external factors too. So let me look at this two ways. The first would have to do, if there are external factors, such as we have a DUI, driving under the influence, or whatever you call that here in Kentucky, operating while intoxicated. If we have the loss of a job, or if we have other external factors that are playing in here, then you have external motivation. Even though the person may not have the desire to quit, he has motivation to quit, he or she. So if you have those kinds of motivations, then you want to use those, to leverage those. So if there's court involvement, then the court certainly can mandate either treatment or jail, and treatment usually is the better option to receive. If the desire is not there and there's no external motivation, then you'll need to look for any internal motivation. The question on internal motivation is, how much is your marriage worth? If you're married, what's this marriage worth? How much do you love the person? If you love them enough that Jesus loved the church enough that he'd give his life up for it, then do you love me enough you'd give this crazy habit up for it? So there's a real question of where the love is in this relationship. Do you love me enough that you would take care of this problem that's driving a wedge in our marriage or our relationship? And if you don't love me that much, then we have a serious question about Ephesians 5 here, which is a spiritual issue. The other thing that I would look at here is that ultimately our sins find us out. That is, if we continue in our addiction, and this one doesn't state what kind of addiction it is, but if you continue in that addiction, ultimately there will be some extremely negative external consequences to that. So it may be a little premature in this, and sometimes in addiction, what we end up saying is the person needs to hit bottom, and this person may not have hit bottom, or whatever is behind this question. It may be that you have to tolerate this for a while until matters actually get worse, but that's only a matter of time, just a matter of a few weeks or months, and it will get worse if the person's not willing to put it in check or to correct this issue. And the question is, how do you instill it in them? The second part of this, the answer is, it's not your job to instill it in them. Their recovery is their recovery. Now, what we can do is we can provide the opportunity, the information, and we can kind of like lead the horse to water, but you can't make them drink. You cannot do someone else's recovery for them. If you do, it's not their recovery, it's your recovery. But what we can do is take care of ourselves. So I get into almost two columns, what I can't do and what I can do. Now, this goes back in recovery to your serenity prayer, that there are some things we can't change and there's some things we can change. And we need to pray to God to help us understand the difference. What can I change? What do I have any power to influence? And what do I have no power to influence? And then based on what we do have the power to influence, based on that, then we draw our plan. The other thing that I would say here is that there are several things that are available, options available to us. One of those, and some of you all may have watched this on TV, Interventionist or Intervention, TV version, that didn't have really is. That's Hollywood. But there is a gentleman that my rich and famous place works with, and his name is John Southworth, and he owns an interventionist group, and they have people all over the United States that deal with this very kind of an issue. When someone will not change, then how do you implement change? The intervention basically is that you contact them, they come and work with the family, and they basically what you do is you cut off all the channels of escape. The person is faced with a choice. You get help or else. Okay? And that pulls together in an intervention. You have all the family members. You have people from the job, people from maybe the neighbors, anybody that person's close to. And the person's sitting there usually saying, I don't have a problem. And everyone surrounding them is saying, oh yeah, you have a problem. And they're calling the detail. In addiction, one of the hallmarks of addiction is that there is euphoric recall. And what that basically means is the person doesn't remember the bad stuff. They remember the pleasure of it. But in an intervention, what you're doing is you're facing them all at once. You're blitzing them with the bad stuff. Okay? And you're telling them that you believe in them, you think they're worth salvaging, and your bag's packed. It's time to go get help. So that's another option available. You may want to talk with Southworth about that. The other one, and I hesitate to say this because I sound like I'm promoting myself, but I do offer a series of retreats where families that want to work on those issues have the option. Oh, that's all I'm going to say on that. So I'm not advertising from the floor. But we do that.
Please list three or four specific things our families can do to protect our homes from pornography.
Sound like the quiz master here. Okay. All right. Three or four things that families can do. The very first thing, I think, and I don't know this question whether there are children in the family, but the very first thing that I would say we can do is have a healthy sexual atmosphere in the home. And what I mean by that is what we talked about in our Sex in the Bible presentation yesterday, that while we're not going to be the vulgar family or the exposing ourselves family, sexuality is a way of life. People have sexual relations. And I think to grow up with instilling a healthy understanding of what sexual relationships are about and that the shop is closed until you're married. I think that's probably the first thing. And the reason that I say that is because the curiosity factor is real major in terms of the internet. Curiosity. I just want to go see what that's like, and then we get caught in it. So if we can deal with that curiosity at a different level, then that's helpful. The next thing is, I believe that we can, so that'd be one thing, have a healthy atmosphere of sexual conversation in the home. The second thing, I think, would be equipment that you can put on your machine, like a nanny protector. Something that screens out the sites. The problem with that is most of the kids know how to get past those quicker than you know how to install it. So that may or may not be something, but maybe for a startup that would be something good. The other thing is that there are sites that will, if your loved one has a problem with this, there are subscription sites you can go to that will give you a readout on all the sites visited during the month on that computer. And that's, again, a way to check. Maybe a fourth thing is position your computer in your home to where whatever's on the screen can be seen by whoever enters the room at whatever point in time. So that'd be four things. The other thing is, if you have a problem with all the above, get rid of your computer. Go to the library. You can go to heaven without a computer in your house. And go to the library. Okay? That's the other thing I had down.
Are addictions hereditary? Drugs, gambling, sex? When does a habit become an addiction?
Are these hereditary? We talk about genetic predisposition. The thing that we do know is that addictions run in families, and usually they're multi-generational. Many families don't know that these things are in their family, especially if it's a family of secrets. We don't talk about grandma or grandpa's problem. One family didn't think they had a problem until we started chasing it back, and we found out that grandma had been a phenobarbital addict, and grandpa had been an alcoholic who died in his car of alcohol poison. Everybody said he had a heart attack, but he didn't. He died of alcohol poison. And then you go back beyond that, and you find that there was another generation and another generation. And what I would suggest is, if there is alcohol in your family needs to know that as soon as possible, alcohol or drugs, because 20% of the population has a different physical reaction to the chemicals once they're put in the body than the other 80%. Now, with that 20% that has a different response, that's where the area of, is there a genetic component to this? That's where that comes in. The current research says that there probably is. The research is not complete yet. Those who are geneticists are trying to identify this particular gene. They have not done that yet, but what they tell me is that they're coming close to that, to identifying where they can almost predict that. The other question, this is the age-old question, is it genetic or hereditary, or is it hereditary or environment? So the other piece of that is, if one is raised in an alcoholic or a drug environment, then that becomes kind of a norm. And unfortunately, we begin, when we leave the home, we tend to search for someone who is like what we came out of, and we're automatically gravitate to the very thing that maybe we are trying to avoid. So I've talked with several who say, you know, I hate what I grew up in, and then it's like, well, who is it that you're hanging out with? And it's like, well, my boyfriend or my girlfriend, they have this problem, but, you know, they love me, and we can fix it before we get married. And then it doesn't get fixed. It's like, well, why did you get gravitated to this person? It's because you grew up with the mentality that you grew up with the wrong definition of some of your emotions. One of the emotions that we mislabel very frequently is the emotion of love. And I love him, I love him, I love him. And then I ask people to say, well, tell me what that means. And what they just give me is not the definition of love. They give me the definition of pity. You know, if I just love him more, I can figure, he's had a hard background, and he just needs someone to love him. No, that's not love. That's pity. And a lot of people get duped into a relationship because they think they love the person, when in fact they pity the person. Okay? And that draws a real interdependence. So let me see what else we got here. When does a habit become an addiction? The operative on that one is the loss of choice. When we have habits, sometimes we say, I don't need to be doing that. We stop. The addiction, once the obsession kicks in, is it's repetitive and it doesn't want to stop until it's satisfied. And so so a person has cravings. They want to maybe go out and have a drink. That craving continues, or that trigger continues, until it has its object. The mind becomes obsessed with it. With a habit, we kind of maybe put ourselves in check on that. What I want to talk with those that are addicted about in terms of habit, and habit is a choice. Addiction is something that is repetitive. And what I talk with them about is you've got to make an intervention early enough. Once these things start kicking in, the cycle starts in, you've got to intervene early enough to where you're not like the rock rolling down the hill. We don't stop the rock when it's halfway down the hill. We stop the rock before it starts rolling, or at the very beginning of the process. So that's the people, places, and things, and staying out of that stuff. Because once this thing gets on a roll, it's going to take some pretty extreme measures to fix. Now, here's the problem in recovery. It's the very thing you don't want to do is the very thing you should do. I don't want to go to a meeting. I don't want to call my sponsor. I don't want to tell anybody about this. I do not want to do that. That's the very thing you need to do when this thing is starting to kick you. And so in recovery, it's very difficult for the addicted person to pick up that phone, to make that call, to change that environment. But that's the very thing they need to do, need to be encouraged to. So the difference in habit and addiction is choice.
What can I do to help someone in my home who gambles regularly?
I was looking at some of these questions. I made a glib comment about this earlier that I won't repeat. And this is not really a funny question. The thing that has to be done with a gambler has to be done is there has to be controls on the money. A gambler can't gamble without the money. And so there has to be controls on the money. I would recommend what could be done is the person who is the non-gambler needs to be in control of the purse strings. And there needs to be accountability for where those finances are. There does not need to be an ATM card. There doesn't need to be charge cards. Basically, you cut off the source of the problem when you address the money issue. Checking account may require two signatures. Put your safeguards in place on controlling that money. And that would be one of the main things that could be done on this. The other thing, I keep going back on this, we're talking about a home here, and a thing that needs to be done in the home is we need to confront the problem. Again, I get back to the thing that if this is driving a wedge in your marriage, what do you love more? Do you love your partner more, or do you love your habit more, or your compulsion, or your addiction? Which do you love more? And you are ultimately going to be forced to make a decision, because this problem won't go away. So you're going to have to make a decision who you love more and what you love more, and ultimately this will break up a marriage. That's as plain as I can make it. So do something now or get ready for a divorce.
How do you answer people who use the example of Jesus turning water to wine, Paul's command to Timothy, as well as some Old Testament passages, to justify small amounts of drinking?
Okay. First thing I'd say is come with me to a therapy group and hear the stories of pain, and you won't need to ask a question like social drinking. But in the meantime, let's answer the question. The water to wine, I think we need to look in the context, because the question sometimes when it's asked assumes that they were having a party. If you read the context, what you find, this party had been going on a couple of days. And what you find is that the amount of beverage that they had planned for this party had run out. The next thing you'll find, and I don't have my Bible here in front of me, but the next thing that you will find is you had, what, eight or nine you had containers that each one holds eight or nine firkins. So what we're talking about is we're talking about gallons and gallons and gallons of wine, okay? And with that, we are not, and they'd already been drinking for a couple of days, whatever the wine that was there, okay? How many firkins do we have here?
Uh-huh.
Uh-huh.
Right here.
Yep. friend?
Mine reads 20 to 30 gallons each.
Okay, all right. So, and how many pots?
Six.
Six pots, and how many gallons each?
20 to 30.
20 to 30, so how many gallons is that? All right, so we just finished drinking whatever was the beverage that we thought would last, and now we got 180 gallons, or 100 and whatever gallons. Okay, so if John 4 authorizes social drinking, then we need to redefine social drinking, because what that would authorize is making drunk men drunker. That's not social drinking. Okay, the other passage we would look at is the one about Timothy, Paul and Timothy. And Paul told Timothy to use a little wine for thy stomach's sake and for thine oft infirmities. That's not about social drinking. The first thing there I want to notice is that Timothy obviously didn't do this. It took a command to get him to touch the wine, okay, even if it was fermented. But it took a command from Paul. Timothy was not in the habit of drinking that the wine that's referred to there. It took a command for him to do that, and that is more in the medical end. Why did he do it? Did he take it so he could get a bubbly feeling? Not at all. He did it for his stomach's sake. He had a stomach problem of some sort, and for his oft infirmities. So he oft infirmity means he got sick. That's medication. Somebody wants to use something with alcohol in for medication, and in this case, Dr. Paul prescribed it. I don't have a problem with that. But most folks that go have a drink down at the bar are not doing it for their stomach's sake or for their oft infirmities. So I would again go to the context on that. The other part of this has to do with the Old Testament, and the question that I would ask here is, what kind of verses are we looking at? Some of the wine is not always defined in terms of fermented or unfermented in the Old Testament, so I'd need to see those verses. Do we have that PowerPoint ready to go? Okay, it's up. All right. I don't always know what goes on behind me. All right. We use this in a couple of our presentations. And in this particular verse, what we have is all three levels of drinking that are talked about. And those are your Greek words there. You can look at those if you want to. The first one has to do with just being sloshed. The second one has to do with the half-drunken revelry kinds of parties. And the third one, the banquetings or carousings, is those that sip the wine, or that's your social drinking. And I want you to notice in that passage, 1 Peter 4, that all three levels are condemned, and we're told in that passage that the time has passed, the time is sufficient, that we would follow the desires of the Gentiles. Which to me, if those three are there, which they are, and I'm told to stay away from those, and that's things affiliated with the world, then I don't know why on earth I would want to say, well, why don't I just have some a little once in a while with people. There are some things that are so dangerous that you don't even want to go near them. And in my experience with the alcohol, that's one of those things. We don't know if we're in that 20% until we get started with it. And by the time you know it, it may be too late to stop it. It has a hold on you. It grabs you and it takes you under. So that would be my response to those.
I have two family members who are addicted to drugs. Now they are having health problems and are relying on me to help out. What is my obligation to them?
That's a good question. There's some details I don't know behind this. This is kind of catches us in the middle of obligation to family versus enabling the addict. I think the first thing I would look at on this is what stage is the addiction to drugs? It says they are addicted to drugs, so I'm assuming that is a current event. I would think first the obligation is that there needs to be some rules set forth that we will help you, but the help is conditional. You help yourself by getting control of this addiction. So that can be treatment. And by the way, treatment doesn't necessarily mean money out of your pocket. Let me just ad lib on this a minute. In 1963, a gentleman named John Kennedy, that you may recognize that name, instituted and sponsored the Community Mental Health Act. And since that time, in communities all over the country, there has been mandated community mental health centers that serve so much. They're located so many miles per capita, and so you have community mental health centers. Those are not-for-profit organizations, and those are sponsored with federal dollars. They're funded through federal dollars. There's research. Most of the research that we have comes from that bill that's sponsored with a group called SAMHSA and also a group called NIDA. The fact is, if you want free material and free research, your tax dollars are at work there, and you can just contact NIDA or SAMHSA, S-A-M-H-S-A, .gov, and you can get that material. They'll send you books on anger management and all the things connected to this, and tell you the latest research, what works on what chemical. That would be a good resource for you to, if you have a library here, and be free. But in the Community Mental Health Act, what basically that did is it established a sliding scale pay so that it's paid based on your income. Those that don't have insurance, that's an excellent opportunity for mental health and addiction help to be had. They will work with you according to your income. So if you don't have insurance, that's a good way to go. If you do have insurance, you can still go there. One thing that I would suggest is that these people need to get some help. Again, if we don't do anything about it, it's not going to go away. Second thing is that they are welcome in your home, or they're welcome wherever you are going to be working with them, but their drug is not welcome. So you're going to need to, first, we will help you conditionally if you get help. Second thing I would suggest is that you make it very clear that the drug is not welcome and the behaviors with that drug are not welcome. So if you're going to come in here and be a dry drunk, which means you're going to act like a drunk even though you're not drinking, or you're going to come in here and disrupt our family, then that's not okay. You're going to need to set some very clear limits if you're going to help them. I'm assuming this may mean that they go into your house, or maybe it's financial that you're helping. Either way, we need to set limits. What are the conditions? And the fine line that you're working on this is you don't want to become a partaker of their sins, but at the same time, you do want to be there for your family. So that's the fine line, and that's where you need to set your limits and boundaries. Where are those limits for you? And that's the discussion you need to have. Now, unfortunately, one of the hardest things when we have addicted people in our families, one of the hardest things is to sit down and have an intelligent discussion about this. So what you may need to do is to get someone who can be a mediator on that discussion. And that can be a therapist. That can be an arbitrary party. It could be maybe somebody from the congregation here. I won't throw the preachers in the middle of that, but that's usually who people recommend. So I didn't throw you in the middle of that. I just suggested that, you know. Back here. Okay. But find somebody that can kind of moderate on that. And bottom line, go into it very clearly that you will not be manipulated into allowing that which you hate in your home or out of your finance. You're not going to support a drug habit. Okay? That one almost reeks of, let's pull you into codependency. Don't do that. There's a book called Codependent No More that if you don't have it, you want to get it. It's by Melanie Beatty, I believe. And there's another one called Beyond Codependency. If you look real close, you can find both of those in the same binder. And read Chapter 7. Chapter 7, Codependent No More. I won't tell you what's in Chapter 7, but read it and see if you recognize that person. Also, the thing is that drug addiction has logical and natural consequences. Now, if a person is choosing to use their drugs, but they're wanting you to be a part of their health problems, then the logical and natural consequence is you need to quit paying for those drugs and you need to start paying for your health care. That's your obligation. So don't supply them with the money so they can keep on using their drugs. They don't need to make a choice. Okay.
What resources would you recommend to children of addicts?
Okay. This one gets into the question of adult children of alcoholics. People who grow up crooked have trouble living a straight life because the abnormal has been very normal. And it's been very normal to maybe have an absent dad due to the use. It may be normal to have an absent mom or to have both, and to basically have issues where we are emotionally or socially deprived due to the usage that's been going around. It's the crazy lifestyle, and it's crazy in homes like this. And so when children grow up in these homes, they grow up, and we talked about maladaptive roles, about the placator and the hero and the clown and the mascot and some of the other roles there. And children that grow up in there learn how to deal with life in a maladaptive way. Now the problem is that as they get older, those tools, those things, those ways of coping that they've used will quit working at some point in time. Usually that happens in the early 30s. And those things stop working. And so now we need to go back and to look at ways that do work, which in a typical family would be things that we had learned as we grew up. But the adults are going to have to learn some of these things later. So what resources are available out there? If you will go to the Hazelden website, Hazelden, I think that's .com, maybe .org, what you'll find is there's a bookstore. And in that bookstore, what you're going to plug in is ACOA, or Adult Children of Alcoholics, and that's going to give you workbooks, it's going to give you reading material, and it will give you various places that you can go to get some help. It'll give you some websites. The other thing that you can do is they have ACOA meetings that are 12-step meetings that you go to, and you'll find a bunch of people that grew up in these kind of homes. Remember, 1 in 4 homes are affected by this, so there's a whole bunch of people out here that grew up kind of around life instead of working through life. And you'll find people that are going to be able to relate to what it was like growing up in that home. So the other places that if this is an adult with this question, if we're dealing with a child, then we're dealing with COA, or Children of Alcoholic Issues, and for them what I'd recommend is Al-Anon or Alateen or Alitot. Alitot's for the little ones that are growing up in all the craziness and don't know what's going on, that are thinking something's wrong with them because daddy's acting funny. Okay? And so the Alitot helps them, Alateen, Al-Anon, and then you have your ACOA kinds of meetings that will help. The other thing that will help is to go talk to a therapist, get into some groups or some activities that you can talk through some of the pain that's associated there. I had one man that when he was drunk, he would call his daughter every vulgar name in the book. And those things just hurt her to the core. She was an adult child of an alcoholic. The way she dealt with that is she took it out in overeating. So she was a fairly large woman. And she took that out in overeating because her dad, the man she trusted most in her life, had called her every vile name in the book and had told her all she was good for and so forth. I won't get into the particulars on that. But when people are drunk, they say things that later they don't remember, but the pain is inflicted nevertheless. Some things you have to work through in a different way. The adult child of an alcoholic is going to, unfortunately, in getting better, they get better much quicker if they do some very difficult work, which is called inner child work. Claudia Black is also a name that comes to mind, and Melody Pia, P-I-A, and she's at the Meadows. You can punch in the Meadows, and it will come up as a treatment center, and Claudia and Melanie are out there. So that will help you some with the ACOA issues. Claudia's a little... Is this recorded? Claudia is a little drier than Melanie. We'll leave it there. Okay. But both of them are good. One you'll have to have some coffee with. The other you can get through pretty good. I won't tell you which one. Okay.
I heard a lesson once that people who are depressed or take depression medicine have a lack of faith. Does the Bible teach that? What are your thoughts on depression medicine?
Okay. Depression has multiple causes. There are some things that are the logical and natural consequence of sin is depression. When our sins find us out, we can have a lot of emotions about that, ranging from tears to deep depression, just feel like the air got let out of our balloon. And so we can have depression over that. I don't know who preached this lesson, but what I do know is that there is an element where we need to be depressed. Depression is a normal mood. Major depression is not. I see David where before the death of his child, that it appears to me when you read through there, he was in a pretty deep depression. He was paying the consequence for what he had done, and he knew it. He was facing it, and he was depressed about it. We talked about Elijah this morning that was on the pity pot, and he was depressed. We have David in one of the Psalms where he says, "No man cared for my soul." That's that feeling of isolation, and I'm in a tunnel, and nobody's here for me. Those are statements that are statements out of depression. So depression can be a normal mood. Now, depression becomes abnormal when it doesn't go away. When the things that aggravated or brought it on, when those things really are not any longer a problem, we can get into more of the clinical area of depression. And with that, I would say that's not a lack of faith. That's a chemical problem. Okay? And we have in our brain certain neurotransmitters. Some give us a depressed mood. Some give us an elevated mood and so forth. But when our chemicals are not working properly in our body, then we can go into a stage of depression. And by this, what I'm talking about is either dysthymia or major depression. Dysthymia is a generalized sadness without cause. We're just kind of, life is dull. Nothing particularly excites us. And that's just, we see the flat affect with that a whole lot of times. And most of folks with dysthymia are functional. They can talk with you. They don't smile a lot. They don't have a lot of mood ranges. It's just a generalized depression. Major depression is much more debilitating, and often with that, we see people that can be incapacitated. You just don't get out of bed in the morning. You stay in bed all day, and that can be that. That's not a one-time episode. That's a continuing pattern. Okay, so I don't know that those kinds of things are matters of faith. Those are matters of body chemistry, that something's not kicking in right. People that have problems with their thyroid sometimes suffer from either a mania or a depression. And so we may have actually not just a neurotransmitter, but we may have some organicity that's going on with us that is actually helping to kind of prompt the mood being a little flat or a little low or real low. So I would suggest that on that we need to check with our doctor and kind of see where things are. And my thoughts on medication for depression is that if a person needs medication in order to bring that mood up, that certainly I believe that is what needs to happen. That we bring the chemistry in the body, bring it up to a right level. Depression at its worst, leads to suicidality, to thoughts of wanting to hurt ourselves. And certainly I would think in those cases, not only do we need to see a professional, but I would think medication to keep us out of that suicidal depression would be very much in order. I talk with one person very regularly who's a member of the church who has bouts where he gets very suicidal. He refuses to go on medication. But I guess I'm his medicine because he calls me whenever he gets really depressed like that, and we spend hours on the phone working through that, and ultimately we get back to where he's going to be okay. But here's what he tells me. He says, "Art, I know my thinking's not right. I know what the Bible says. I know that I shouldn't be even thinking about hurting myself. But it doesn't go away. And I just keep trying to rationalize in my mind how I could do that." I have another fellow that calls me semi-regularly, and he tells me, he says, Art, he says, when I get like this, I just think the world will be better off without me, and I drive a lot, and I'm just thinking maybe if I don't make this turn, I just keep going straight over the embankment, that it'll look like an accident and everything will go on. My family will be better off without me. Okay? Now, they appear to have a pretty natural family. I'm talking about members of the church, those last two. Those are indicators of depression. Do they need medication? Absolutely. Absolutely. Okay?
This will be the last one. We're just about out of time before we take a very, very brief break. Tell us a success story, especially if the person became a Christian.
Okay. There are successes, okay? I spend so much time, people say, well, how do you deal with this all the time? I deal with it by looking at the successes rather than the struggles and the failures. Not everybody makes it. The sad thing about addiction is that there is death or insanity. I've had people that have come through that I thought got it, they didn't get it, and we get a call a few months later that they died either an alcoholic death or something that was alcohol or drug related. And we get that. That is unfortunately the nature of this stuff. It will kill people if it is not arrested. The success story, two of those actually come to mind. The first is a gentleman, I won't tell you what he did because you've got two people here that do the same thing. But this is a gentleman who's a salesman, I'll put it that way. But he's a salesman, or was, and what he decided to do is to quit selling, or to quit his sales, because his sales job was actually contributing to his use. That the people he was serving expected him to go out and kind of close the deals with a drink, or they'd go out to lunch, and they'd close the deals with a drink, and he'd come away, pretty loaded for the afternoon, having had liquid lunches. And he was very successful. He and his family would be very well off. But what he opted to do, and this was his first time coming into recovery, what he opted to do was basically to put his job on reserve to take a family medical leave of absence, which is an extended leave of absence from his company, and to get the treatment he needed. This was a man who attended church services, he and his wife and his two little girls, and what they would do is, while everybody else is worshiping, he would slip to the back as if going to the bathroom, but he'd go down the street, and he'd get blitzed, and then he'd come pick them up after services. That's what he did. That's a sad story. The glad story is this man got help. He was in treatment for about 10 days in a detox and a rehab, and what he said is, that's not going to be enough. I know if I go home, I'll use. And so he came to long-term, and he was with us in long-term for about 90 days. At 30 days, he thought about it, and he says, I'm not ready. In 30 more days, he says, I'm just getting it. And then in 30 days, he says, my head and my heart are now in this. He's been clean now for about 2 years. He's been to he's my groupie, among others. He comes to just about everything that we do. His family's involved in treatment. His two girls are involved in treatment with us. They come to his two little girls. They come to the groups. They have made a family thing out of recovery. So they go to their meetings, and they found a place where there's an Alcohol Anonymous meeting, where there's an Al-Anon meeting, and where there's an Al-Atop meeting, all in the same building at the same time. So they go in this building, separate for an hour, but they've made a family night out of it. And afterwards, they go to a movie together. So they've actually made this a lifestyle. They've done what we have recommended. And now he is beginning to give talks and presentations at various places. And the most recent thing is he decided that he could not hold the job he was holding and be clean at the same time. So he quit. He put first things first. If he's not thinking right, then nothing else is going to be right. Good man. Good man. Take a lot of courage. That's success.
Let's take a quick break and 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 quick break.